This year, experience the NHL playoffs your way. Want to watch a single? Do or die Game 7, a full week of heavy-hitting back-and-forth series. Then check out Sling's 1, 3, and 7-day passes. Watch The Chase for the Cup on ESPN and TNT, starting as low as $4.99. No long-term contracts or overpaying. Just live hockey at home or when you want it. Sling lets you do that. Visit sling.com to learn more.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Drake.
Well, one of the biggest ogre-like nutterers of the group, Rex Heuermann, stood in a Suffolk County courtroom, hands shackled behind his back, and admitted to taking the lives of eight women across a killing spree that lasted from 1993 all the way to 2010. After nearly 3 years of maintaining his innocence after he was caught, but if you're looking at the full timeline of living a life, we're talking almost four decades of maintaining that innocence. The man prosecutors called the Gilgo Beach serial killer has changed his plea, guilty on all counts. In a hearing that lasted roughly 30 minutes. It was quick. It was in. It was out. Families of the women he killed wept as he spoke very bluntly, very plainly. Yes, he pled guilty. His own estranged wife and daughter sat in the back row. But a guilty plea isn't the same as answers. And the questions this case leaves behind may be more unsettling than the ones that it actually resolved. We're going to go through this in two parts today. We're first going to talk about Heuermann's guilty plea and exactly what happens next. And then in our next part of the conversation, we will dive deeper into the area of Asa Elrup, his wife. She made a statement at the end, a lawsuit that has now come up against her and her daughter. And the questions that people have there, not to accuse or anything of that nature, but just to discuss everything that's going on around this case. So joining us this morning to have this conversation, Eric Faddis, defense attorney, former prosecutor, and of course, my co-host, Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program. Eric, let's start here. Heuermann he pled guilty to seven murders and admitted to killing an eighth woman as well, Karen Vergata. This was one that had been kind of sitting there in the ether, like, is it going to be tagged onto him? And at the last moment, it was, but it was as part of a deal, but not formally charged with her death. So he admits to it, but not formally charged. Help us understand. My first question is literally kind of the dynamics of what this actually is. As a former prosecutor, walk us through what that trade actually looks like behind closed doors. And what did prosecutors get in exchange for not charging him with Vergata's murder? And did her family just get shortchanged?
Yeah, Tony, it's rather unusual to build into a plea that a person is going to admit to a crime, but never be charged or convicted of that crime. Is it sort of lip service to the family? I hate to put it that way, but trying to have some modicum of accountability without real accountability legally, it's rather unusual. And so what are prosecutors getting out of it? I guess they're getting out of it some closure, hopefully, for the victim's family in terms of what happened to this person. But no legal charge, no legal conviction. A little strange.
So what does that mean to the case itself, of Vergata's case? If there's not a conviction, if there's not a charge, is it a cold case? Is it just, how does it get classified going forward in a legal, because I mean, there's got to be a mark on this on the file somewhere.
Yeah, I would imagine that it's just like a closed case at this time without any legal resolution. Now, it seems like there is a admitted factual resolution, but quite unusual. And you know, I can't imagine where that family's at with that. Is this satisfying to them? Does this, you know, bring what they're looking for? And I'm just not sure about that.
Yeah, and Eric, still the striking thing with all this, as all these things are with Huerman, is what is he getting out of this? Because, again, death was never on the table. And the only thing I can still think of is the currency is knowledge aspect of it. What are you legally thinking that his defense team was able to get in some sort of benefit, if anything, except notoriety for Huerman?
Robin, Huerman's attorney did make a statement after the plea hearing and essentially said the reason Huerman did this was to not put the victims' families through the horrible crucible of trial, whether that was a real motivation or not, that's questionable, to not put his own family through the gruesome details of what these acts that he committed. But I think also that, you know, things were just mounting against him. He lost this important motion trying to exclude the DNA evidence. And I think that might have been the nail in the coffin, and perhaps he was just kind of tired of fighting. But there's no real tangible legal or otherwise benefit that he's getting from this. And the sentence is kind of a foregone conclusion at this point.
I know, and everyone's got to remember, there is zero motivation for anyone who is so psychopathic to do any act of kindness for any other human being, because why would he? It's not in his DNA. So this was totally self-serving to me, and give him zero credit for anything he did.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that. I mean, and sometimes we think really deep on these folks, and sometimes there is a lot of real complex, weird thinking that goes on, and it takes, you know, some mind power to try and get there, trying to get behind. But sometimes these folks operate very simply. I mean, and sometimes it's very childlike. And if you look at Huerman in a lot of ways, he is very childlike. I mean, I go back to thinking of like a child. My thought is, like, remember playing Monopoly as a kid? Very contentious game, it seems. There were a lot of us in childhood where, you know, sometimes people cheat. They're the banker. They're this, they're that. But I remember playing Monopoly against people. And sometimes you'd get the kid that you get so far into the game, you spend hours doing it all this time. And then, like, the deck is stacked against them because they made bad choices, or just because it's the luck of the draw. It's how the game went. And then, you know, there's maybe another hour to play. Like, I quit. I'm done. I'm out. That kind of reminds me of what Huerman is doing. And they don't care. And everybody's like, "What? We got to get to the resolution here. I quit. I quit. You guys can win." And they don't care about anybody else's time and effort that was put into this. They're just, that's the best thing for them. And then, this is what I think is interesting. We have an interesting element of Huerman's plea that we learned about the other day. The FBI's Behavioral Analysis Unit is going to jump in here with him. He's agreed to cooperate with them, which is interesting. I don't know if he watched too much Mindhunter and now he's thinking, great, I get to be in part two or what. But it feels like, I'm wondering if that's been a motivation of the kid who wants to quit the game, and then another group in here says, we want to learn why you want to quit the game. And I think it's wonderful. I think it's great the FBI can get in there and learn shit from him, but I think that might be more the modality of his thinking of why he's quitting the game. And it's not necessarily for the benefit of his family or the victims. It's because, guess what? There's a new spotlight that's coming your way from the FBI. Remember that TV show, that series that everybody talks about where these people become more famous for doing horrible things? You get to be one of their next stars. That might be his motivation.
And if I could add on to that and then put it to Eric for a question, if he's seen this before, because I was asked this on another show this morning I was interviewed for, and that is, they were going in anyway.
Yeah, true.
I mean, the BAU, part of the big thing that the profilers do is they do research, and they do research by interviewing everyone they can get access to. So regardless of whether it was part of a plea agreement or not, you really think they weren't going to try to interview Huerman? Do you think they weren't going to make those attempts? They were always going to make those attempts, because every single, so inside the Bureau, there's multiple BAU units, one, two, three, four, that actually focus on different types of crimes against adults. And then you have one for crimes against children. And each of them does research in these areas, because that's where the profiling comes from this research in all these areas. And so to me, it was almost like an overplay of cards to saying, hey, look, I'm doing this. Like you said, Tony, I think this was about notoriety, not mm-hmm. about reality, because they were going to go in anyway. Now, will they have, because again, do you really think he is going to give more or less information based on this plea agreement? He's still going to try playing with him. He's still, remember, his only currency is information. And if he gives mm-hmm. up everything without trying to get something in reciprocity, he has no currency left. So I don't like giving him credit for giving access or his team access that they were going to get anyway. Because here's what happens psychologically. He's going to be in isolation for quite a while, if not a longer quite a while. Mm-hmm. When you have limited access to human beings, the need to communicate and share your story of how grandiose and how awesome you are builds exponentially. And if all of a sudden someone comes in to hear your story, do you really think he's going to say, go away? Yeah.
Yeah.
But the question then to Eric is, Eric, have you seen that as part of plea agreements often, and or is it common, not common?
I would say it's very uncommon to build that into the plea agreement. Like you said, sometimes those things happen after a person is incarcerated just organically. But to build that into a part of this legal document is also somewhat unusual. And I think, yeah, you guys are both right that this is his chance to sort of live in infamy. And I think, Robin, too, that he's gonna play a sick game during some of these interviews. I think he's going to give little breadcrumbs here and there. But withhold some information because that is the way he maintains that control. And so this could be a long series of interviews over the course of years.
Yeah.
And Robin, I agree. I mean, they would have gone in regardless, but I wonder if they use it as a carrot on a stick where it's like, you're going to go in regardless. And maybe Huerman doesn't know that, but he thinks maybe it makes him more special. Maybe, I mean, yeah, I'm wondering if it was just, I'm curious as to how that even came into the equation where it was like, was it brought up and like somebody noticed he really perks up when somebody mentions this, like, what if we build that in? What if we use that as the, to inspire him to plead here, because we're going to like make him think, make him feel like he's special, like he's really worth studying. And maybe that will be enough motive for him to put him over the edge and say, I did it, so we don't have to go through this trial and all this rigmarole and everything. I'm wondering if it was kind of, I mean, it's like a child. It's like, if you're really good, we'll get ice cream on the way home.
You know, Tony, you are so spot on. I got my goosebumps going because I think that if they did that, I think that is a genius move.
I think it was.
I think so too. So here's the lever you could use, that lever. So, I mean, it's a lever of influence on Huerman. It's the lever of notoriety.
Yeah.
And when you can say, Dennis Rader didn't get this deal, but you're getting this deal if you do this X, Y, and Z. That's like a lever of notoriety.
Exactly. And it's bullshit, but it's if you can make the, if they want to believe it, they can believe it all they want. But in reality, it's not true. It's like, but if that's what gets you to just fess up to this and take accountability and everybody can move the F on, then let's pull it.
Have you ever watched the sitcom The Office?
Mm-hmm.
And in the office, Dwight's the assistant to the regional manager, which means nothing. That's what this is.
No, I think you're exactly right. Eric, investigators found what they described as the blueprint for the killings in Huerman's computer checklist, reminding him to, it was a ridiculous list. It was things where you're going to go do this and you need this on paper to limit noise, clean the bodies, destroy evidence. I mean, this wasn't necessarily impulsive. Like if he actually, I got to clean them. I mean, this was methodical. I mean, if you had been the prosecutor walking this case into trial, how do you present that document to a jury without letting the horror of it overshadow any sort of legal strategy? I mean, it feels like it's a pretty good slam dunk, but there is no slam dunks in a case like this.
Yeah, you know, in a case like this, you have to prove after deliberation. You have to prove this was premeditated, that he thought about it in advance. He planned it out. And that blueprint is Exhibit 1. I mean, look, it talks about supplies that are needed. It talks about protocol. It talks about what he's going to do to the bodies and also talks about problems to address to try and avoid detection. I can't think of a better piece of evidence to show that this was well thought out. It was not something that just happened spur of the moment during some dispute with these escorts or something. This was methodical and calculated. And yeah, that's exhibit one.
One of the things that has come out, his attorney said that pleading has given his client a great sense of relief. Him, a great, a huge sense of relief. Ehrman's attorney. What do you think that relief is? Relief that his methodical, like we were just talking about, his planning documents, because he was so detailed in everything. The fact that that's not going to be exposed in court as the cluster F that it is, or is it that he's relieved that now he, in his mind, with the BAU coming in, he can control the narrative. He can control what version of his story he tells to people, and it's not being told by a district attorney in a courtroom. Now, granted, people can see through it, but he doesn't think that far ahead. He's just caring about what's coming out of his mouth. Is that the relief you think that he's feeling? Where do you think, what type of relief and why do you think he's feeling relief, if he is at all?
Yeah, in my impression, it's something along those lines. It's that, and I think Mark Fry commented earlier something similar, that he still gets to keep his secrets, or at least he's the gatekeeper of those secrets still. Mm-hmm. And that includes, you know, the details about motivation. That includes how he selected these folks and what he did and sort of the gruesome goriness of all of that. That's something he gets to keep, and he's going to be able to share it at his discretion when he feels like it. He might share part of it. He might share another part another day. And so he maintains that control, and he will maintain that control indefinitely. And so this sort of allows him to still kind of be on top in his mind, in the sense that, you know, not all of my dirty laundry, not all of my skeletons, forgive the pun, are going to be disclosed. I'm going to be in control of all of that, and I will remain in control, even with the FBI, as the years go by.
Yeah, I love that statement. Gatekeeper of his secrets. That's what he's still maintaining. I hate when guys like this win. So, I mean, I still think this is a win for him. He's not subjected to cross. He's not subjected to having all his secrets exposed, not at his discretion, but someone else's.
I mean, excuse me. Any evidence that was against him that would have been presented at trial will eventually kind of come out here.
Yes.
Excuse me, just as we saw with Koberger in the weeks and months after that, it's just not going to be presented in the, you know, on the stage, on a courtroom stage, as it would. Michael Brown, defense attorney, he says he expects Ehrman will have something to say at sentencing in June, which might be interesting. I mean, this kind of harkens back in my mind to BTK when he did his whole spiel in detail for like an hour in Wichita, saying, here's what I did, how I did it in great detail. What do you think we might see here in June? Obviously, we saw the quick plea the other day of, yes, I did it, and he's guilty on those charges. It didn't go into any other detail, but usually sentencing is where we're going to get victim impact statements and also a statement possibly from the defendant, if in fact he chooses to give one. Do you think we're going to see something here?
So at sentencing, Tony, every defendant has what's called a right to allocution. So they have a right to sort of make a statement and say their piece. Is that what he's going to do? Was this sort of some foreshadowing that sort of you know, tickles Ehrman in the sense that he's got a future spotlight? He's still going to be the star of the show. And hey, you guys all should wait with bated breath as to what he's going to say. This is going to be about him. And I'm just wondering if that's sort of the impression that I got from the statement of his attorney. You know, will he go into details? Will he talk at length, or will it be something very limited? It's a little hard to say at this point. My guess is that it might be something a little more limited, like, I'm sorry for my actions and the harm that I caused. Who knows? It could be an hour-long rant like Raider.
Yeah. I'm really hoping that the families, when they give their victim impact statements, talk to the Gonzalez family and the statement they made at Koberger's sentencing, because they eviscerated him. And I hope these families get up there and don't allow him to be the hero, don't allow him to be center stage, but they eviscerate him up there, because that's what he deserves.
I wonder if Ehrman is capable of feeling. And I think Olivia Gonzalez got to Koberger.
Yeah.
There was some reaction there for a person that we look at Koberger. And before she gave her speech, I would have said, I don't think anybody's going to get through to him, no matter what. I don't think there's anything, but everybody has a pain point somewhere. And it's on people like this. It's not usually where one would expect it to be, because they don't operate like us. So the things that would hurt us if we were to hear them are not the same things for them, but she knew how to dig into there. I wonder if Huerman has a pain point, or if, I mean, he's much older than Koberger, so more, far less green in this world. I just wonder if there's a lever left to reach Huerman on that level. What do you think, Robin?
I think so. I think because they're very similar in the sense that Koberger, theories by many, including myself, was that he was a serial killer in making, mm-hmm. but just sucked so bad at it, he got caught after the first. Mm-hmm. I think the pain points are very similar on this. And I think some of the things, one of the reasons why Siobhan Scott said the other day was that he targeted Elsa for recruitment/wife was because she idolized him.
Yeah.
She saw him as the knight in shining armor. If someone goes in there and diminishes what that viewpoint of her was to him, and that how he wasn't a man to anyone, just like they did with Koberger, I think that could be a potential pain point to hit.
Yeah. I could definitely see that being a point. Give us your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'll continue this part of the conversation right there.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Megan Waterman called her daughter every single day. It didn't matter where she was or what she was doing. When you're 3 years old and your mother is the center of your world, your call is everything. And Megan understood that. Whatever else was happening in her life, whatever circumstances pushed her into the work she was doing, the call home was non-negotiable. It was how her daughter knew she was safe. It was how her family in Maine knew she was alive. When those calls stopped in June of 2010, nobody waited around hoping for a reasonable explanation. They knew. Within 2 days, Megan's family reported her missing because Megan Waterman did not miss phone calls to her daughter, period. The last image of Megan alive exists on a surveillance camera at a Holiday Inn Express in Long Island. It shows her walking through the lobby and out the door at approximately 1:15 in the morning on June 6, 2010. She's headed to meet a client. She's been posting Craigslist ads from the hotel room, talking to family on the phone, checking in with people who matter. The camera captures her leaving. It doesn't capture her coming back because she never did. The footage is grainy. Institutional, the kind of security camera footage that exists in every hotel lobby in the country. It captures a young woman in motion, mid-stride, walking towards a door that leads to a parking lot that leads to whatever was waiting for her outside. There's nothing in the image that suggests she knew what was coming. Nothing that suggests she hesitated. She was going to work. She expected to come back. The camera recorded the last normal moment of her life, and nobody watched the footage until she was already gone. Megan was 22. She was from Scarborough, Maine, a small town just south of Portland where everybody knows everybody and the pace of life moves slow. Her early years were marked by difficulty, a turbulent family life, teenage run-ins with the law, the kind of instability that narrows your options before you're old enough to understand what options even are. She had her daughter young. She was devoted to that child in a way that everyone around her recognized. Her aunt Elizabeth Misserve described her simply, "Megan was loved by a lot of people, and this affected a lot of lives." The thing about Megan is that she wasn't operating in some faraway world disconnected from the people who loved her. She was a daughter, a niece, a mother, and she was in constant contact with all of them. The decision to travel from Maine to Long Island to work as an escort wasn't made in a vacuum. It was made in the context of limited opportunities in a small Maine town. The financial pressures of raising a young child and the reality that the work paid more than anything else available to her at 22. She booked the Holiday Inn Express. She set up her ads. She maintained her routine because the routine is what told her family she was okay. Relatives saw her board a Concord Trailways bus around bound for New York. She arrived in Long Island, checked into the hotel about 15 minutes northeast of Gilgo Beach, and got to work. On the nights leading up to her disappearance, she was talking to family, posting ads, managing that schedule. Earlier in the night on June 5th, surveillance footage showed Megan in the hotel with a man identified as her boyfriend, an associate who went by Vibe. He left the hotel earlier in the evening. Megan spent time alone, calling family, and then posting more on Craigslist. And then around 1:15 a.m., she walked out. When Megan didn't call the next day, her family in Maine noticed immediately. And by June 8th, 2 days later, they reported her missing to the Scarborough Police Department. The reason they gave was telling. It was unlike her not to call them to check in on her then three-year-old daughter. That sentence in the missing persons report tells you everything about Megan's character that actually matters. She was consistent. She was present. And when that presence vanished, the people closest to her treated it as the emergency it was. But despite the quick report, the investigation moved slowly. Megan was an S worker from a small town in Maine who'd gone to Long Island to work. The jurisdictional complications alone, the Maine Police Department, New York Police Department, Suffolk County, and created friction. And in 2010, the term Gilgo Beach hadn't entered the public vocabulary quite yet. There was no known pattern, no serial killer narrative, no framework for understanding that Megan's disappearance was connected to other women's deaths. She was a missing person. And missing persons cases involving S workers in 2010 didn't generate the resources or the urgency they deserved. They still don't. 6 months later, on December 13th of 2010, Megan Waterman's remains were found on the north side of Ocean Parkway near Gilgo Beach, wrapped in burlap, bound alongside Maureen Brainerd Barnes and Amber Costello. Melissa Barthelemy had been found 2 days earlier. The Gilgo four were together in death, within a quarter mile of each other, in the thick brush just off the highway. Megan was 22. She'd been in the ground for 6 months while her daughter grew up without her in Maine. While her family called police and waited for answers. While the man prosecutors say was responsible went home to his own family in Massapequa Park. And according to investigators, continued searching the internet for information about the case and for images of the victims and their families. The DNA evidence connecting Huerman to Megan's death is built on one of the most consequential investigative decisions in the entire case. When the task force zeroed in on Huerman as a suspect in 2022, they needed his DNA, but they couldn't tip him off by requesting it, so they followed him, surveilled him, talking about his daily routine in Manhattan. And on a particular day, they watched Rex Huerman eat pizza and throw away the crust. Investigators recovered that crust from the garbage, what's called an abandonment sample, legally obtained because Huerman had discarded it in a public space. They tested the DNA on the crust against genetic material recovered from the crime scenes, and survey says it's Rex. It matched. Specifically, prosecutors allege that a male hair found in the burlap wrapping around Megan's remains was linked to the Huerman pizza crust DNA profile. The burlap that someone had used to wrap and conceal her body allegedly carried physical evidence of a man who put her there. That's the investigative moment that cracked the case wide open. A discarded pizza crust in a Manhattan sidewalk tested against hair from burlap recovered from a body dumped in Long Island brush. 21st century forensics applied to evidence that had been sitting in an evidence room for over a decade. Without that crust, without the surveillance, without the willingness to wait and watch, Hiraman might still be living his life in Massapequa Park. The DNA match gave investigators what they needed to get warrants. The warrants gave them access to his house, his devices, his history, and what they allegedly found inside rewrote the case entirely. Prosecutors allege that Hiraman's internet search history, recovered from electronic devices seized during multiple searches of his home, included more than 200 searches related to the Gilgo Beach investigation. He was allegedly monitoring the case, checking on the progress of the investigation into his own alleged crimes. But it went further than that. According to court filings, his search history also included searches for images of the victims, and not just the victims, their family members, their sisters, their children. Let that register. According to prosecutors, a man charged with killing these women was allegedly searching for pictures of their kids, of their grieving relatives. He was allegedly consuming the aftermath of his own violence as if it were content. As if the suffering left behind was part of the experience. The prosecution's theory of the case rests heavily on the idea that Hiraman operated on a schedule dictated by his own family. Every murder he's charged with allegedly occurred when his wife and children were out of state. His wife, Asa Alrup, and their children would leave for trips, visiting family, vacation, and the house in Massapequa Park would be empty. And according to prosecutors, that's when Hiraman allegedly activated. He'd purchase burner phones. He'd contact a victim through Craigslist or similar platforms. He'd arrange a meeting. And then once the act was allegedly done, he'd dispose of the phone, dispose of evidence according to the checklist prosecutors say they found on his laptop, and wait for his family to return. Megan Waterman disappeared on June 6, 2010. Prosecutors allege Hiraman's family was out of state. The Holiday Inn Express, it's less than 20 minutes from Massapequa Park. The Craigslist ad Megan posted that night was a kind of an ad Hiraman allegedly responded to repeatedly, using burner phones that pinged the same cell towers in the same small geographic cluster around his home every time. Megan walked out of that hotel at 1:15 in the morning because she thought she was going to a routine appointment. According to prosecutors, she was walking into a trap that had been set by a man who'd allegedly been doing this for years, who had a system, a method, a timeline calibrated to his family's travel schedule, and a house waiting in the suburbs where prosecutors allege unspeakable things happened when nobody was home. She was a mother. She was 22. She called her daughter every day, and the day those calls stopped, her family knew something was wrong in a way that no investigator had to explain to them. They lived with that knowledge for 6 months before her body was found. They lived with it for 13 years before someone was arrested, and they're living with it now, waiting for whatever comes next in a case that has taken more from them than any courtroom proceeding can give them back. Megan Waterman traveled from Maine to Long Island to earn money for her child. That was the whole reason, not because she wanted that life, not because she'd chosen it as a career, because a three-year-old back home needed her mother to figure it out, and Megan was figuring it out the only way she could. She was consistent. She was present. She was in contact. And the night she walked out of that hotel and didn't come back, the silence was deafening to the people who knew her, because Megan Waterman did not go silent. Her daughter is a teenager now. She grew up in Maine, surrounded by family who love Megan fiercely and who have spent more than a decade trying to reconcile the woman they knew with the way she was taken from them. Megan deserved to go home. She deserved to make that call the next morning and hear her daughter's voice. She deserved to be 22 in a world that offered her better options than a Craigslist ad and a Holiday Inn and a midnight appointment with someone whose name she didn't know. She got none of that. What she got was a stretch of highway brush on Long Island's South Shore and 13 years of waiting for the law to catch up the man prosecutors say was responsible. Her family didn't wait in silence. They pushed. They reported. They remembered. They refused to let Megan become another name in an unsolved file. And the fact that her three-year-old daughters missed phone calls is what triggered the alarm. That's not a footnote. That's the whole story. A mother who never stopped being a mother, even when the world gave her every reason to disappear. She didn't disappear. She was taken. And the people she left behind made sure the world knew it. Give me your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We're this week, as Huerman, we're recording this before he does, allegedly plans to plead guilty. We are taking a look at every one of the victims that has been identified and connected to Huerman, all seven of them in this series. One more to go. Press subscribe. And we will continue our conversation in the comments section. Links are in the description. Until then, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now. And don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
From ESPN's 30 for 30 podcast, this is Murder at the U.
Did you say someone got shot?
November 2006, a college football star on his way to NFL dreams, gunned down in broad daylight.
Just bone crying, and he said, "Coach, they killed him."
No weapon, missing witnesses, conflicting accounts, and for years, no arrest.
She insinuated that the Miami PD had done nothing, and it became a little bit more accusatory.
The case goes cold, rumors spread, and the truth gets buried. Until now.
His world could come crashing down. According to him, it was over.
The ending, something no one saw coming, because this story isn't over yet. From ESPN's 30 for 30 podcast, this is Murder at the U. Binge the full season right now, wherever you get your podcasts.